Welcome, everyone. My name is Riley Jimison of Riley's Reptiles, and tonight you are here for episode 11 of the Reptile Room podcast. And if you notice that Andy is not here, you are correct. He is not here. Andy, like the rest of us, have had their lives impacted by COVID-19 and the global shutdown, whether it be more work or less work, one way or the other. Andy's life has only picked up as far as work and things go. And on top of the family and the household, he's just got a lot going on. So we're just going to trudge on through. We took a little break and decided to just get back on that horse. And Andy, even if he isn't here audibly, he is still helping out with editing and getting things rolling and published. So whenever his life, you know, comes back to order as far as work and things like that, you know, hopefully he'll come back on. But for the meantime, we're just going to keep steering the ship forward as best we can and try and still do an episode every other week and get back on that midweek schedule. So, but bringing it back, trying to get this thing back up and running again, I had to reach out to somebody. I wasn't about to sit and talk into the airwaves by myself. So tonight we're joined by a man of many hats, the so-called reptilian octopus, Mr. Justin Smith, who you know of by such endeavors as Palmetto Coast Exotics, the Herpeticulture Podcast, the Chondrocast, Herpeticulture Magazine, Snakes and Stogies on YouTube. I mean, dude, like, what else do you do? Like, do you sleep at all? Like, welcome, Justin.
I do. I do sleep. I like my sleep a lot, so. But it's kind of funny, like, that Snakes and Stogies gets kind of lumped in with all that stuff when I really consider that, like, a leisure thing. Like, me and Phil just do that for fun. It's just kind of morphed into, like, oh, Justin's doing another podcast. And it's really not. It's me and Phil talk a lot. Phil Wolf. And, you know, we talk on the phone a lot. We both like cigars. And so we are having some really good conversations about different – it's a lot of venomous stuff that we talk about on that. So I was like, why aren't we recording this? You know, it's just – We originally did it on Instagram, and I was like, man, we need to find a way to save this because some of it's really good information. Yeah. So we ended up just doing the live stream thing on YouTube.
Well, that's kind of nice because it's like a no frills, no edits. You just point, shoot, upload, and be done with it.
Yeah. And I mean, that's how THP and the Chondrocast are too. I really don't like editing and having to go back and listen through everything, and I'm lazy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, once you get your settings dialed in as far as how it records and everything, you should in theory be able to just plug and play and kind of have some confidence knowing that your settings have been tuned the way you want them. And yeah, you and Jacob have such a good dynamic that it literally does sound like y'all are just leisurely having a good sit down chat conversation about something and just happen to record it.
Yeah.
So yeah. I can see why you think that. Yeah, for sure.
I don't know. I just, like, you know, a lot of people on top of that,
you run the Chondrocast.
Yeah, but that's kind of been backburnered. That's one of those things where it's like, if I feel like doing it and I have the time, it's like, who should I, you know, I'll hit up David or whoever, Luke, sometimes they'll kind of alternate the co-hosting thing. And then it's like, who's free this week for this? And they'll be like, I am. And then we'll, mm-hmm. You know, we'll just do it.
That's pretty rad. I don't know anybody else who runs two podcasts.
Yeah, it's definitely nice having, like, with TCC being kind of, it's like, when I feel like doing it, that's when I do it. You know, I'm not on any sort of set schedule or anything like that. So it's convenient. Less pressure, less stress.
You can fit that in sort of when everything else affords you opportunities.
Yeah. And it's funny because that's the one I sort of get a lot more messages about. A lot of Chondro guys are like, when's another episode coming out? And I'm like, I have no idea. I haven't, you know, that was the one thing that I figured would get backburned before everything else. You know, just not having the time. So. But I also find that one's really hard to do because
that one already has.
That one's tough to do too, because when it's like a single species or group sort of niche podcast like that, it does get hard to not have the same conversation every episode, just different people, you know.
Sure. Yeah, that I understand. You have a more narrow focus there for a more narrow discussion base.
Yeah.
So you and Bratz have been doing THP for 2 years now.
Yeah.
The ChondroCast has been going for a while. You've mm-hmm. been doing your own endeavor, Palmetto Coast Exotics, for years, but how did it all start for you? Because I know your dad also keeps snakes and has an interest in snakes, so it sounds like you were sort of born and raised into, you know, being exposed to snakes. Is that right?
In a way. You know, I was a Navy kid, so we moved around a lot. The story for me is very similar to pretty much everybody else. You know, I was very big into dinosaurs and then realized I wasn't going to find any dinosaurs. And since we moved around so much, I kind of became very attached to the hobby and just the interest in general. I mean, I don't want to be one of those people that's like, I've been keeping snakes since I was six, you know. I have been keeping snakes, you know, off, you know. There's been very few times in my life where I didn't have snakes in my household. But it was just always something that I could take with me no matter where we went. You know, that interest was always there, but my dad, when he was a kid, you know, they had, that was like the 70s and stuff, you know, they had rattlesnakes and caimans and whatever weird freeform things the 70s afforded. And so, I mean, he always sort of had an interest in it. I wouldn't say he was, you know, he's never been super invested in the hobby. He's never been very active in the community. It's always just been something he's just kind of done for fun. You know, as a result of that, though, I mean, my parents let me keep a lot of stuff. Like, I think they sort of noticed from an early point that was kind of my thing. And I think they noticed even more as I got older that it wasn't going anywhere. And so I think they finally just sort of came to the realization, like, that's my thing. So they kind of just let it fly, you know?
How old were you then?
So the first things I was keeping, I remember I found a little decay snake at one point and I absolutely fried it. I left it on my desk in front of the window where the sun was in the afternoons and just baked it. And I was probably, that would have been 1996, 97. After that, my dad was a big hunter and we were living up in the Charleston area, South Carolina at that point as well. And my dad came home with two rough green snakes he had caught. And so I ended up keeping those for a while. And I'd go out in the backyard. Yeah, man. Went out in the backyard and caught a bunch of grasshoppers and I'd feed them and watch them chase them down. And that was cool. And then we moved to Virginia and I didn't have anything that I can remember at that point. Then we ended up going to, I want to say it was Hawaii, and then to Connecticut, and then back to Virginia. I can't even remember. I can't keep up with the order of things anymore. But it was in it was the early 2000s, between 2000 and 2004 that we were in like the Norfolk area of Virginia that my dad started breeding corn snakes. And I was keeping stuff at that point, but my dad decided to start breeding. And so I got involved with that. I can't take a whole lot of credit for it. I was just kind of there, you know, wasn't doing a whole lot of the work, but I was having all the fun. And I don't know. From that point, it always, you know, it stuck and I always had stuff, you know, always had something definitely in my room.
Yeah, it's like right around the same, time. So 90, 98, 99, that time of area or time period when I was started keeping snakes. And mm-hmm. I started with a cow king. So I hear you. That's cool, man.
Yeah. Well, we were in Hawaii. And as anybody knows, you can't keep snakes in Hawaii. You know, it's illegal. But they did have, right. Like, you would find these roadside shacks that were selling, you know, Jackson's chameleons, because Jackson's chameleons are introduced. So while we were in Hawaii, I did have some Jackson's chameleons. I did not keep them the way they were supposed to be kept. They did not do well. But I would find those little blind snakes, which I thought was pretty cool. Seeing some of those blind snakes, you know, in the garden was neat. It looks like a little black earthworm until you look at it. You can see the tiniest tongue, you know, come out and flick around. So.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's always something to.
Yeah, they're the only snake out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's definitely tons out there, especially with invasive geckos and chameleons on certain islands.
Yeah, we were on Oahu. That's where my dad was stationed at the time, in Honolulu there, which is the capital of Hawaii. And I don't recall there being, like, the Felsuma problem that they had, you know, problem, quote-unquote. But there were definitely a lot of house geckos. Mm-hmm. And I know up in, like, the mountainous regions is where they're finding a lot of the Jacksons and, you know, the Costa Rican erratus. And, well, not Costa Rican, they're Hawaiian erratus now, but... the dart frogs up in the mountainous areas, which we didn't get to do a whole lot of exploring of. It's gorgeous there, though.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Wow, dart frogs living in Hawaii. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I can see it. Yeah, that's interesting. So at what point did you take, like, your life... your life interest in reptiles and sort of just kind of this myriad of collecting and keeping things in the house throughout the years in different places you've lived in. At what point did you decide to, I guess, make it more of a staple part of your life and your hobbies or priorities or any sort of focus in that regard?
Ooh. So my dad retired in 2004. And that's when we moved back here to Beaufort, South Carolina, which is where all my family's from originally. So this has always been home, no matter where I was living. This is where I always wanted to end up. And so once we had sort of settled there, it's kind of funny. We packed up all the corn snakes we had at the time, which was, I don't even remember how many. I think when he sold off a good bit of them, I think we had like 120 or so at the time, if I'm not mistaken.
Holy cow.
Yeah, so we moved all those down here. We were living in some sort of townhome my grandmother had owned at one point. So we stayed there. She lived somewhere else. I don't remember where, but we moved in there. My dad wanted to thin out snakes even more because at the time we had them in one of those storage units and we were keeping them there, like one of the climate-controlled ones. And I think we were trying to be super secretive about it because I guess if they had found out that there were live animals in there, they probably wouldn't have taken too kindly to it. But so we ended up selling off pretty much everything there. And then I think I got into carpets around maybe 2005, 2006. I had just a mixed, like a coastal jungle mix cross. And then, I ended up with an IJ, and those are what got me hooked, man. Like, I got into carpets early, and so that's, like, I think that's what sort of chased me away from all the other stuff, you know, like ball pythons and whatnot, and like carpets. I got carpets and realized very quickly that these were just something different.
Yeah.
But then it grew into more arboreal stuff. It grew into, you know, Amazon tree boas. And I was big into Nicaraguan boas at one point. I had some other odds and ends. Like, I've had some Tarahumara boas. I've had a couple of ball pythons here and there. You know, ended up with them for one reason or another. I don't even remember why. But had those. And, I mean, they were cool. I just never really understood the hype. But I think when you're getting into carpets and then you go to something like that, it's kind of like, these just aren't as exciting, you know? I did have a period of time where I didn't have a whole lot of snakes. I maybe only had one or two, and I went through a really hardcore invert phase, so I had a ton of scorpions and tarantulas. And then, you know, I took a break from the hobby for about a year. So I didn't have anything except my female Indian ornamental tarantula.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got, I had a friend who was, she got some crested geckos and the breeder sent her a freebie. And she's like, you know, I don't really have any need for three. I wasn't expecting three. So if you want this one, you can have it. And so I got that and quickly realized how enjoyable those were and ended up, you know, started getting some pairs and I eventually got a big group together. That's when I started Palmetto Coast.
Okay.
And that was kind of a sort of a, not necessarily a scary decision, but it was something I'd wanted to do for a long time where it's like, it's time that I want to do this, you know, as a hobby business or just a little side business, whatever, nothing crazy. You know, I have these Cresteds and over time, I bred those for probably 3 years or so. And then eventually decided that I was kind of burnt out on them and I just wanted to stick to snakes, and snakes were kind of always at the core of what I was doing anyways, and got into chondros and brettles and bear drets and all that good stuff. So
aside from chondros, brettles, bears, what's your collection looking like these days?
I mean, outside of those, I've got some corn snakes. I've got some boiga. I have a lot of, I wouldn't say a lot of dart frogs. I got a handful of dart frog tanks. I've really gotten into those the last 2 years or so, year and a half, 2 years.
Yeah, you have.
Yeah, and you know, it's, I remember like the old issues of Reptiles magazine, dude. I wanted dart frogs so bad. They were so cool. But at the time I was like, they're expensive. I probably won't be able to keep them alive, like whatever. So now that I'm a homeowner, I'm like, I can do whatever I want. So I kind of went a little crazy, you know, and started with a Phyllobates vitatus tank, and that quickly then morphed into some Raina timaea and more Raina timaea, and then Dendrobates leucomelus. And so, I mean, I don't think I have a lot as far as dart frogs go, but I've got a modest little collection that produces plenty, and it's pretty much the right amount of fruit flies and stuff I want to deal with.
Nice. Yeah, you've got a good system for your feeder colonies and keeping up on that.
Yeah, and I have a lot of people ask me about dart frogs and, you know, how hard are they? And I think that's the hardest thing, honestly, is timing the feeder cultures, you know, timing your fruit fly cultures right and when to make new ones. And if you can do that, and I also have a backup source of rice flour beetles, which is really handy. If I don't have fruit flies, that's a nice alternative. Mm-hmm. Those are basically like miniature mealworms. Like imagine a mealworm, but way smaller. The beetles are way smaller. The worms are way smaller. They're about the size of a fruit fly. So they work out really nice.
Nice. Yeah, they have fast metabolism. So you have to be on top of the food source for those little critters. You have to not only be proficient with your keeping of the frogs, but proficient with staying on top of your husbandry systems and culturing food and all that. It's a lot of work.
Yeah. Well, it sucks because if you end up feeding off, you know, a culture too early, then it doesn't really ever take off. And then, you know, if you wait too long, a lot of them sort of die off and then you don't have any flies. So you just got to, like I said, it's sort of getting into the groove and getting the right cadence in the sense of when to make a new culture or two.
Yeah. I find the cultures I make at work of, I think we'd use Heidi Eye. I think mm-hmm. those tend to produce the best around the four and a half week mark.
Yeah. Right now I make new cultures like every 2 weeks. And I find that's sort of when the cultures I made previously start to sort of peak and there's more than enough flies in there for me to start feeding. And that's just so like within the next 2 to 3 weeks, those cultures I just made to replace the ones I was, you know, the ones that are producing, they're ready to go too. So I've kind of found the right amount of flies for my group. And like I said, having those rice flour beetles as a backup is really handy in case you forget or things get busy or, you know, culture crashes or something. Having a backup feeder like that is really smart. And Rice flour beetles are nice because they require zero work. You put them in a tub with, you know, wheat flour, rice flour, coconut flour, whatever, and just leave them be. Put them in a dark closet and just give them a couple weeks. They do take a little long to start producing, but man, once they are there, it's so many, it's insane.
Yeah, and for your frogs and the fruit flies as well, the ambient room temperature in your snake room, provided by all of the other cages and heat and everything, is perfect for them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was a point where I had my incubator in my snake room. I don't right now. It's in my closet, but I didn't have any eggs in it, but it was still running. And so I dropped it down to like 80 and I just put cultures in there and they took off real good at a nice stable 80. So now I just put them on top of a cube that has a chondro in it. And that's sort of like on the window side. So it does get a little warmer over there and they seem to do all right. But my room stays in like the maybe 75 to 77 or so during the day. So it is kind of a little warmer than like the rest of the house. I keep the thermostat set pretty low, but with everything in there running, it definitely bumps it up a good bit.
Yeah, so it sounds like you've kind of got an ambient climate suitable for the various species, and then you run everything with hotspots to their specifications per species, aside from the frogs and the bugs.
Yeah, I have things that are – I'm a big fan of the Reptile Basics Ultratherm heat pads. I like those more than, you know, the box store brand ones because they don't get nearly as hot. And most of the chondros have a heat panel, which I also run kind of on the cooler side. You know, I don't really want to give them – I don't really give them like a hot spot per se. I keep more of it like a ambient cage temperature rather than a dedicated hot spot. And that's just because I – you know, chondros I think don't need to be kept super warm. I think they seem to do better in sort of just an ambient overall stable temperature. But like all the rat snakes, all the corn snakes, you know, the boiga, none of them are really specific to anything in particular, like I have with the heat panels. And then some of my brettles, gotcha. they don't even have heat. My brettles just stay at whatever the room is and they do great.
Yeah. They're bulletproof animals.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if I were to ask you, where do you see your collection going in 5 years? Obviously, you've got some projects that are long term. You're building the Baird's Army. You are dead set on chondros. What are you what's your long term goals, man? Like, what's the trajectory for your snake projects?
I have a bunch of chondros right now. Probably half of what I have chondro wise is still, you know, 2 years or younger. So by that time, I'll have a really nice diverse group to work with. Some really cool bloodlines, some really cool locality stuff. So that's something that I got my eye on down the road for sure. I'll definitely have more Baird's pairs. Baird's consist about half my collection right now.
How many do you have?
Oh man, let's see. That's six. I believe nine. I think.
Wow.
I had some. I lost them when they were young. You know, like when they were babies. I got some fairly recently, and they rolled on me. They, you know, they ate, and then they re-urged, and then they never sort of bounced back from it. So I lost two of those, but other than that, I mean, they're very easy snakes to keep. But yeah, I've got a big group of those, and then I really want to pursue boiga a lot more. I have my pair of cyania right now. I love those. Those hopefully will be ready within the next year or two. And then I want to get more into that genus overall. It's just such a cool group of snakes, and they're also, I think, severely underrated and severely underestimated as well. You know, we talked about them. We talked about them on THP last week with Nathaniel at M Toxins, and you know, I think pretty much any rear fang snake.
Yeah, I listened to that. That was great.
Yeah, even if it's a hognose, man, I don't think it's.
That was a great.
Always be wary of them.
Yeah, definitely. Made me think a lot about these hogs over here, although they're not, like, I don't know if they've ever tried to open mouth strike at me more than, like, once or twice, but I'm definitely more hands-off with them, and I've read one account where somebody had a rather, like, bad cat bite level of irritation sort of thing, like swelling, inflammation, burning, that whole thing, but it only lasted like a day or so. And that was just that person's reaction. So right. Who the heck knows how I would react. So, but Boyga, man, talk about a seriously cool genus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like I said, severely underrated, man. I don't know if it's the rear fanged aspect of them and, you know, them not being like a hognose where they're kind of derpy and they just kind of, you know, they're all bark and no bite. And I mean, I'm sure it's the legality as far as venomous goes in most places too, but I don't know. I don't want to take a bite from any of mine. I've seen some really big cyania. I've seen some really big melanota, and I am convinced that a very good sized boyga like that could really, really jack you up if it wanted to, you know, if it got a hold of you good enough.
Oh yeah, I believe it.
And then eventually,
yeah, those things are—they're serious. They're switched on.
Huh?
I said they're very switched on snakes.
Yes.
They're ready to roll the whole time.
They are not a play with me snake. That is for sure.
Yeah.
Mine hate pretty much any interaction I have with them.
Yeah. They're pretty high strung animals, man. They're twitchy.
Yeah, I think they're a lot like chondros, so, man. They do great if you just ignore them.
Yeah, they're an animal that gives you the feedback by being left alone with the dialed in husbandry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I provide them with a ton of, you know, foliage, and you get those big bundles of fake ferns from Walmart for like $5, and I'll take like two or three of those and just stuff them in there and basically make it so that I, you know, if I'm looking at them, I can't really tell because they blend in so well with them, A, at least the cyania. And then B, it makes them so much more, they feel more secure when there's a lot of visual bearers from what I can tell. They just, if you make it so they can't really see you unless they're out and about, you know, the better off they are. And then they have some of the elevated hides with the David Broms at Specialty Color Designs makes these brackets for those Reptile Basics, Vivarium Electronics, whatever brand they are.
Yeah.
And I offer mine those, and they live in them, man. They absolutely love them.
Yeah, those things are so cool. That's such a brilliant idea, making the tracks for the product that already exists.
Yeah, I wish you'd make a, like, the big ones, but I don't know what all is involved in that. I need to talk to him about it because I know these are going to outgrow the ones they're in now fairly soon. They grow stupid fast.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if there was a way to make it for the extra large hides, that would be pretty cool because then, you know, carpet python keepers could even offer them in cages because I've got some adults that use those XL hides, and if I were to put one on the roof, I'd be curious to see if they use them. But anything smaller than that, I just feel like they wouldn't use it.
Right. Yeah. I could see Amazon's using them. Carpets, pretty much any variety of carpet, I can see just going crazy in it. I feel like there's a lot of the Asian rat snakes, and even some of the North American rat snakes would probably use them a lot too.
Yeah, or with this huge influx of people trying to get into super dwarf retics, you know, if they're actually staying under 8 feet, an extra large hide suspended off the ground would be very attractive to a super dwarf retic.
And that's what I love so much about
I think
David's products is he just You know, all of his stuff is just so versatile. You can use it for so many different species, you know, whether they're arboreal or not, you know. He just, everything he makes is, you can use it for anything if you wanted it to.
Yeah, they're all great products for sure. The innovation behind them is just top shelf. So I know the story behind how you and Bratz met, where y'all are at in Beaufort, but and I'm sure, you know, if anybody's listening to this, they've definitely heard your show. But how did THP come about? Where did the idea for you and Bratz to start the podcast come about? Because I know how you guys found each other and linked up, you know, realizing there's somebody with similar interests in the area, and that was kind of like lightning striking twice as far as
that.
Odds
yeah,
goes.
That was nuts,
so
man.
Because, hit it off really well.
Yeah, the hobby is not big here. It is. It does seem to be growing, but it seems like it's a lot of boa guys and stuff around here, not a whole lot of Morelia guys. And so I was like, what are the odds that there's this kid keeping, you know, a lot of the same stuff that I would be keeping if I had a choice? And, you know, being a carpet guy too, I was like, this is too weird to be a coincidence. But yeah, I mean, at that point, Joe Phelan had started his podcast From the Ground Up, and I remember watching that and being like, man, this would be really cool to do. You know, I just didn't want to do it by myself. And so it just so happened too, about that time, you know, I'd been kicking the idea around for a couple of weeks, but then Brock showed up and I was like, I think this is my guy. And so we started it, and we're like, we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know where it's going to go. It may not take off. You know, we might just have 10 people listening to it for the next 10 years, you know, whatever. We're just going to put it out there and see what happens. And here we are two years later.
Yeah. Who'd have thought y'all would have such good chemistry and like dial it in so well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny too, because I remember when I brought it up to him, he was kind of like, what do we talk about? I was like, well, I don't know, but we'll figure something out. Like, we'll just go. And so originally it was just going to be us two. And then eventually I was like, man, I want to get people on, you know, I want to get guests on. And so then we ended up finding the gear to do that. And that's what it's, you know, we have our little routine now, and that's what it's been ever since.
That's pretty sick, man. It's really cool to see the chemistry y'all have, like, because the show has evolved so nicely over the years. And I mean, it's a testament to your guys' hard work and consistency and commitment that you have sponsors, and you've been crucial components in carpet fests and fundraiser events, and, you know, promoting breeders and projects by having certain folks on the show. It's pretty amazing to see like exactly what's gone on in just two short years for your guys' show. So that's pretty rad, man.
It's,
I mean,
definitely surprised us.
I don't mean to like your horn, but you guys should definitely be very proud of the work you've accomplished.
It took off way quicker than we ever would have thought it would. I was sure that for like 4 years straight we'd have, you know, a very small listenership. We'd have, you know, maybe we wouldn't even be doing it that long. It was just, we had no idea sort of what was going to happen. And so I pretty much told Bratz getting into it, I was like, let's just let it go where it wants to go. You know, don't try and force it in any one direction, but just see what happens, you know? And I think like, I'm also very, I want the way that me and him are on the show is the way me and him are off the show. You know, I never wanted it to be like we're personalities in a sense. So, I mean, when you're hearing us talk on the show, I mean, that's me and Bratz when we're just hanging out and bullshitting.
Right.
And I think that plays a part in why it's kind of done well. People feel like, you know, it's the same conversations they have with their friends, you know, their buddies when they're sitting around drinking and, you know, just kicking it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you saw the recent video that Garrett Hartle put out with his editor sitting there talking about, you know, a commonly asked question about how to start a YouTube channel. And one of the main points that they discuss in that as as that's considered, is very applicable. And that's just doing it and just being yourself, because mm-hmm. you can do something similar to what somebody else is, even if you follow their model, it is still uniquely yours, your style, your approach, right. or whatever. And, you know, those are your experiences. And if you're consistent and you just keep doing it, people come back because they're curious about your experiences mm-hmm. and your input and your take on it. All of a sudden, what's bringing people back is you, and not necessarily the content. It's you and your original thought and authenticity within it. So,
yeah, but that's another aspect that I do really, I really try to focus on too, is, you know, the guests. I'm kind of particular about it. You know, I want to have people on that maybe not necessarily get asked to come on shows very often. And I want to talk to people that are focused on one species, like the Europlatus episode we did with Kat Saldana. That's, I think, the number one. That's the second most popular episode we've ever done. And I think it's because, like, I want to focus in on sort of those odd species that, you know, people keep but aren't sort of popular, but everyone's interested in them, you know. So I try to, like, we're both snake guys, me and Bratz, and so it's very hard to find, like, do episodes sometimes where there's not really snake stuff related. Like, I try not to be NPR 2.0 in a sense where it's all carpets all the time. So I, you know, I do try to vary it up. I do try to offer more than just snakes and stuff, and, you know, touch on venomous and dart frogs and just any, like, Abronia is something me and Jake are both interested in, and we don't want to have any desire to keep it, but we want to, you know, we want to talk about it. And I was talking to Forrest at one point about doing an episode on him, and, you know, unfortunately that never happened, and, you know, then he passed away, and so that was a bummer. That was that's kind of a regret that, you know, we didn't make that happen sooner. But
sure. Well, he did manage to get the Abroni Alliance up and running, and you know, he's a major part of that foundation. So mm-hmm. I'm sure you could, you know, you can make that happen. I think you and I were talking a few weeks ago, and you were like, how is there not a dart frog podcast? Like,
yeah.
How is there not one? It's such a huge established part of the hobby. And yeah. If anybody out there is listening, Justin just called you all out. All you dart frog people, Justin called you out a few weeks ago. We're just publicizing it now. Because there is not a dart frog podcast when there really should be. I mean, you could get into Bioactive and
false bottoms, plants, and the groups,
the plants, the lights, and you know, there were papers done recently about how dart frogs create little internal maps in their head so they can navigate their way throughout the forest and get home and get to feeding spots. I mean, all I see is nothing but endless potential.
Oh yeah. There's no shortage of people out there.
Yeah, and you know there's tons of people out there that keep them. So if anybody out there is listening and has been on the fence, do it.
I don't think anyone, like, one's even been attempted. Like, there hasn't been one where someone's like, yeah, we did like 4 episodes and then we just kind of never did it again. Like, that does, like, no one's, it just seems like no one's flat out tried or even done one. And I'm actually even amazed that like, well, Josh's Frogs or one of those bigger companies haven't jumped on it yet. Mm-hmm. And
Well, if somebody wants to get one going and they call it Ranitamaya Radio, I just want a little bit of credit. That's all I'm saying.
There was, you can ask Bratz, man. There was a point in time where I was really kicking the idea around, but I didn't feel like I was the guy to do it, just because I hadn't been in darts very long. And I was like, I don't want to be the guy that's like starting a podcast, you know, brand new to the sort of the scene and doesn't know anything about most of the species, and then saying I'm going to have a show about it. But he talked me off that ledge. Him and Billy Hunt talk me off ledges all the time when it comes to ideas of doing something else. I think it's got to be exhausting for Billy.
It'll be worth it.
Well, if I had the time, man, I'd be doing them all day.
What he signed up for.
Yeah, I don't. Well, I don't know. I don't think he did. Yeah.
Well, if there was some sort of a reptile network studio thing that supported you know, content makers mm-hmm. Of any kind. And it was like a contract subscription based sort of thing with a big parent company that just managed all these, you know, talent and shows and things like that. Then you could have it for sure. You know, like there could be a whole section of like people who full-time podcast and teams that work mm-hmm. on it as funded by, you know, whatever organization. And it's all about, you know, the new wave of radio and content generation that is soon to replace TV.
Yeah. And I know like a Dark Frog podcast has been talked about with some breeders. They just haven't done it yet. I know it's like I've asked around and been like, how come this isn't a thing? And a lot of people were just like, I either don't have the desire or I don't have the time or both.
Because they all have too many frogs to feed and take care of cultures.
Yeah.
So speaking of motivation and podcasts, what motivated you to then, on top of your breeding projects, on top of THP, start ChondroCast?
That was just wanting more GTP Keeper Radio, honestly. Like I went to Bill Stegall.
Buddy Buscemi, those guys, their lack of content inspired your content generation.
Yeah, but I went to Bill Stegall before I even started it and said, hey, I know you guys are busy. I know you guys don't crank out a ton of episodes. I was like, I want to start a Chondra specific podcast. You know, if you're cool with it, I'll do it. But I was like, I don't want to be trying to replace you guys or like step on any toes or feel like I'm trying to like sneak my way in as far as like that kind of thing goes. And sure. Bill was completely sure. cool with it. You know, Bill was like, yeah, dude, do it. And, you know, of course I was like, I'm going to do an episode every week. And then after a while, it's like, I'm going to do an episode once a month. And now it's like, I'm going to do an episode whenever I feel like it.
Yeah. Well, no one blames you. You do a ton.
Yeah, I mean, I like me and Billy say all the time with the magazine, like if people want to complain, you know, it'll fall on deaf ears because it's free. So no, you're under no obligation to take in any of it.
Yeah, no, that's very true. We're not making any money off of this type of content generation, so. You know, unless you're Joe Rogan doing, you know,
multi-million dollar deals a week
and, you know, yeah, exactly. With sponsorships and all this stuff for underwear and kettlebells and brain powder and all this stuff. Yeah, it's just not happening. So,
but I think that's why a lot of people don't
pursue. You shouldn't try.
Yeah, I think that's why a lot of people don't decide, you know, they want to do a podcast, but they don't. They want to do a YouTube channel, but they don't. You know, they're just worried about people not liking it. And as someone who, I mean, I've gotten a lot thicker skin over the years since doing THP and stuff. So now I really don't care. I mean, I do value people's input as long as it's constructive. But if someone just messaged me and says, hey, you suck, I'm like, okay, cool. You know, I think a lot of people are just terrified of getting that negative feedback. And I mean, yeah, like negative feedback of any kind sucks. But when you get the messages from people that are, you know, super appreciative of doing an episode on such and such species because they've been really curious about it, but they don't know who to talk to or there's not a lot of good information out about it. You know, that's what it's that the core group of people that listen to it. Those are the ones that you're doing it for, not the random passerby that just likes to, you know, talk shit about everything.
Right. No, I agree. Yeah, you definitely learn what's important to you and how to not let things get under your skin. So,
but so I think it's just people are just afraid to put themselves out there. You know, you got like starting a YouTube channel. People just they don't.
Yeah.
You just got to do it. You know, you got to just take a leap. Well, it's gonna suck, but you'll be surprised at how soft the landing actually is.
Yeah. I mean, it's awkward at first. You got to rip the Band-Aid off. You got to put out confidence, project confidence, tell yourself you're good and confident, and it'll come out that way. And eventually, you know, if you just keep going at it, it sort of snowballs into a natural thing.
Yeah.
but it is uncomfortable at first. You just gotta do it. Like, if it's something you really want to try, just do it. That's the only way you'll know if it's worth doing.
Well, it's also something you have to sort of stick with, you know, like THP, I knew, like, the first, how, like, indefinitely, I knew, I was like, we're going to get, like, very little traction, we're going to get very little listenership. I was like, so it's going to be kind of brutal, because I feel like we're going to be playing to an empty room, more or less, and it's just one of those things. Sure. I told Jake, I was like, you know, it's going to be rough to start, like, we're not going to have anybody paying attention to this thing, but over time, you know, it will take off, and same with the magazine, same with ChondroCast, you know, it's just, you gotta keep doing it. And I mean, YouTube videos, like, I do have a YouTube channel. I do have, there's one for the podcast. We don't do videos nearly enough, and it's mostly because I hate editing videos. It's such a time suck. But I mean, content is content. You know, I'll think of a random topic that either I don't think there's a lot of information on about, or, you know, I want to put my thoughts out about it. And I'll just record it on my phone and upload it. You know, it's like, yeah, it's not a high production quality. It's not anything fancy, but I know there's someone somewhere that's going to benefit from this information. So a lot of the videos I do on my YouTube channel are Chondro related, and it's almost always me making a video that for questions I get asked a lot on any of my social media channels. And I don't do that mostly because, I mean, like, I do answer them, but it's also like, you know, there's probably other people wondering, you know, how long does it take for Chondros to change color? You know, how long should I, you know, how often should I feed them? How often should I handle them? You know, that kind of thing. So it's just putting stuff out there. You just got to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Referring back to that video that Garrett just put out recently, that's another thing that he talked about was he went to his sort of most frequently asked questions, mm-hmm. and that's how he decided to make video topics based on what he was getting asked most frequently. One, because he knew that it was relevant and people were asking about it, and two, because it was kind of also functional for him to be able to just send that link or yeah. answer it on there instead of having to repeat himself over.
Yeah, and that's it's definitely a perk for that as well. Like, that has helped with chondros. People ask me, you know, how should I keep, you know, neonates? And it's like, oh, well, I have a video on that. And, you know, watch this. And then if you have any more questions, hit me up. I don't turn people down when they ask me stuff. I'm always around to help. I tell people that all the time because people are always like, you know, I know you're super busy, you know, and I'm sorry to bother you. I'm like, no one's ever going to bother me. Like, I may not get to your message right away. Right. I'm usually pretty quick about it, but I'm never going to be like, sorry, dude, piss off. You know, I'm always, my door is always open. I tell people that all the time.
Yeah.
Like, never hesitate to message me. Never hesitate to email me. You know, whatever, hit me up.
Yeah, I think people just get a little concerned that they're going to upset somebody or ask a stupid question or come across as too new and naive, mm-hmm. To get the respect and warrant the answer they're looking for sure. So I think that's great that you put yourself out there like that. I try and do the same as much as possible. So yeah, I mean, answering questions and being available is the only way we can sort of across the board help get people in there. And then putting out shows is another tool, another passive form of consumable information for the masses. And it can only be beneficial if it's, you know, genuine yeah. good information. So
yeah, and I mean, that's something I sort of learned from Harlan Wall. You know, Harlan's always available, and there's no such thing as a short conversation with Harlan, but every time I have a conversation with him, I've learned something. And so, you know, I try to adopt that. Like, he's very friendly, he's very easy to talk to, you know, he's a wealth of knowledge, and so it's like I want to sort of carry on that sort of standard operating procedure in a sense. And, you know, I think people get intimidated by the right. Chondro community, especially because it is sort of a, I'm not going to say like snobbish, but there is sort of this like thoroughbred-esque sort of mentality about it. And so I think a lot of people mm-hmm. are intimidated because there's like very expensive snakes. There's people that have been doing it a very long time. Like there's just this mentality that people think that, you know, we don't have time to talk to you lowly peasants. And I don't find that to be the case at all. Like, I'll talk chondros with anybody, man. They're awesome snakes. You know, I'm always willing to help people. And I've made so many mistakes with chondros, dude, that if someone messages me and they have that problem, I'll tell them straight up, like, I killed a snake doing this, so don't do that. I want people to learn from my mistakes.
Yeah, for sure.
So they don't repeat themselves.
Yeah, and people appreciate it. You just, you know, you're not going to hear as much of the positive feedback as you will negative stuff or whatever hysteria people have, you know, focused on at that point in time. So it's a labor of love, and you just got to keep putting one foot in front of the other, keep going until you have that moment where you look back on what you've done and you realize not only are you X amount of time and episodes deep, but you also have a lot of folks who've come out and said they appreciate it or have benefited from it. And you just kind of see what you've built. So, and then on top of all of this, you've gone and set your seventh and eighth arms of the reptilian octopus to running a magazine. So you have two pairs of arms running two podcasts. You have another pair of arms taking care of snakes, and then you've got arms seven and eight running a magazine. So if anybody was wondering why I call you the reptilian octopus. So magazine is a fantastic thing so far. I don't think I've heard any one bad thing about it from anybody. It's been nothing but like consistent, solid, good articles, photographs, like a nice spread, a good variety of subject matter and contributors. Like, and you're doing that for free as well. And I know you did just start a Patreon rather begrudgingly, and I know that you're not doing it for the money, but dude, like, you're putting out a ton of content and you do it for free essentially, other than the people who generously donate voluntarily. Like,
And
so let's talk about the magazine. Let's talk about how you got that rolling and how you even have time to do all of this.
So starting it, it was originally like, I think early like February of 2018. I had worked for a like a PR social management sort of like marketing firm for about 2 years. And about 6 months into working there, the owner of that company decided he wanted to start doing some magazines for some of the communities down in like the Hilton Head, South Carolina area, which if anybody knows, it's a very, it's like a retiree island. So there's a lot of communities where people don't really leave the gates of that community. They've got shops, they've got pools, they've got all the stuff they could ever need to where they don't have to leave the walls of these places. And so he started doing a magazine that was completely focused on residents in each of these communities. Like for one community, they got a magazine. For another community, they got a magazine, and it highlighted different people and local events and stuff like that. And it was free. It was one of those things. It was completely advertiser driven. That's how it was free for people. And so I pretty much took that business model and everything I learned at that job, which was learning social media management, learning, you know, I did ad sales for a little while, which was like pulling teeth. I'm not a salesman by any stretch of the imagination. Learning how to build websites. And I mean, all of this with very little help, you know, this guy really pushed us in. We, you know, we didn't know how to swim. And so it was one of those, just throw you in. And if you, you know, sink or swim. And so I ended up, I actually started there doing some writing for a pet and wildlife magazine he was starting at the time. And then it quickly morphed into me doing photography and writing for some of these other magazines and then copy editing and a bunch of other stuff. I mean, I learned so many skills at that job. It's ridiculous. And so I pretty much decided after, while I was at that job, that I was like, you know, I have all the resources to start a magazine. You know, I miss the way some of the older magazines are. And so I was going to start my own. It was going to be digital because print's so expensive to do in bulk that I was like, I'll just do it digitally. It'll be free, whatever.
Right.
And so I started it on my own, realized very quickly that I couldn't do it. And that was, now that I'm looking back on it, that was almost entirely because I sat at a computer all day and the last thing I wanted to do was come home and do it some more. And so, and then when you're doing that by yourself, you know, it was tough too. But then, last year, Billy Hunt of Uwabami Reptiles came to me and said, hey, if I help you, you know, will you bring it back? And I said, sure. And I mean, within a month and a half, we had the first issue out, and now I'm working on issue 9 right now, I believe. And I mean, yeah, it's definitely it's a lot of work. It's a labor of love. I like to think that it's pretty well received, just judging by the small amount of hate mail I've gotten. I think that's a pretty good litmus test. but yeah, I mean, a ton of work goes into it. I do all the designing on it. Billy helps out a ton as far as like hitting people up for content and getting it to me and talking to people. And, you know, he's now doing all the merch stuff. So we got some shirts available and whatnot right now. We're actually, me, him, and Phil Wolf, we're talking about vending Daytona in August, hopefully. We're trying to kind of get a game plan for that together. And
is that happening? That's still on yeah, and ready yeah. to go?
As far as we know.
Nice.
Yeah. So we're hoping we can vend that. If not, we'll definitely go all out and vend next year. But it is a lot of work, you know. It's literally like we have a whole sort of routine of things where it's, you know, the first week of the month I usually kind of take off and don't do anything with it. And then the second week I'll start sort of getting together content and figuring out what goes in that next issue. And then we get the we like to stockpile articles and stuff. And so we have a whole folder full of just what I call spare content and, you know, stuff that I like to try and decide how much of what, you know, whether it's snake articles or herping or turtles or anything like that, try and balance it out and decide what goes in that issue. And then it's a matter of, you know, finding a photographer that has an image of a relevant species that's an article in that issue, and talking to them about, you know, doing the cover image, which a lot of the photographers that we've done so far have been super cool about it, super helpful. And then it's, you know, making sure we have all the content together, the articles, the photos, and then I start laying it all out, and then it's putting it all together and making sure it's all right. Even your teeth are blue, kid.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of work. My child has, she ate a popsicle or
you
something.
You ever see the magazine?
So she had to show me.
Nice. The good old days.
Much.
Do you ever see the magazine getting to a point where you get like ad space sold from companies and put it into some sort of rotation and a subscription basis in order for it to become sustainable and fund, you know, articles and projects and photographers and things like that? Do you ever see it growing to that level?
I don't know that it'll ever be a subscription based thing. I like the idea of it being free. We do have, I mean, Reptiles Express is an advertiser. I use them for shipping stuff and I love them. They're great guys. Mike Arnold's my boy. And then I know Focus Cubed Habitats has done a few ads with us, and Ashley, who's one of the co-owners, she submitted a handful of articles to us for a handful of issues, and she's absolutely knocked it out of the park. She's been super easy to work with. And so, I mean, we do. I haven't shopped it around a ton, honestly, mostly just because I want to be able to have more statistics and more numbers to take it to people and be like, here's what our readership is looking like. Because, you know, in the beginning, I told Billy, I was like, I'm not even going to think about sending it, like, shopping around to anybody because we don't have any numbers. Like, people are going to see that it got, like, 60 reads in 2 weeks. They're going to be like, no thanks. You know, so I wanted to build the numbers a little bit.
Yeah.
Then be able to shop it around. And we've had some people message us about advertising in it and that ad sales, you know, especially in print, even though it's digital and print, if people want it to be in print, it's tough. You know, if you have to really sort of enjoy rejection because you're going to get it a lot.
Yeah.
You know, you can message.
It's a good skill to have.
You can message 30 people and you'll have maybe one or two that'll be like, yeah, sure, I'll do it. So you have to go into it pretty much expecting them to either blow you off or just flat out tell you no. So it's tough, but yeah, sure. I mean, it's same with the podcast. Like I told Billy, you know, just wherever it goes, it goes. If it ends up getting to the point to where it can be a full-time thing, like that's awesome. I'll do it in a heartbeat. We're on the ninth issue, which is hard to believe because it feels like just yesterday we were putting out the first one. But like I had to literally like teach myself Adobe InDesign for that first issue, which Adobe programs are just, they can do so much that it's overwhelming and you don't even know where to start. So I've gotten that down pat pretty well.
Yeah,
now
that's a lot.
Now I'm playing with Photoshop a little bit and kind of learning the ropes on that to make it even better and make the layouts a little more creative, a little more interesting. So yeah, I mean, man, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of teaching myself how to do things via YouTube. Skillshare has been a big help. So yeah, I mean, it's there's a lot of hours that go into it, and you know, you'll spend a month working on an issue, and then you'll see, you know, the average read time of the latest issue is, you know, 5 minutes, and so it kind of sucks when you think, man, I just poured all these hours into this and people are just kind of flipping through it real quick and then sort of putting it down. But, you know, that's sort of the name of the game. The attention span of the average person isn't what it used to be. You know, it's
sure.
Each issue I like to think is a pretty decent size given what it is. It's, you know, most issues hover around the 50, 55 page mark, which to Billy, I guess, is a lot. I wanted it to be more. He taught, that's a ledge you have to talk. He had to talk me off of. Because I was like, more. There has to be, you know, it needs to be 60 pages. It needs to be 70 pages. And Billy's like, dude, it needs to be like 45. I was like, you're out of your mind.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I guess I was expecting it to be like Italian Vogue and be like a half inch thick. I don't know. But it's been fun. I'm enjoying it. You know, it lets me get my creative.
Well, that's what counts.
My creative outlet, you know, it lets me, I like the design aspect. I like laying out the articles and, you know, making it look pretty.
Yeah, absolutely. I did a little bit of that when I was young in like elementary school or middle school or something like that. I think I was on, like the yearbook committee or something like that. So I was involved in a lot of the formatting and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, we did it all by hand, on paper.
With glue sticks. So.
Yeah, drawing, rulers, blue pencils, chalks. Like, yeah, seriously, dude. It's old school. So, no, that's really cool, man. And then, yeah, so snakes and stogies, you've sort of just evolved into by virtue of all of your other endeavors that have connected you to all these folks over the last few years. And now with the world being so digitized, it's almost easier to have video chats with people. And when you have really good video chats, you find yourself thinking like, man, I wish we recorded that, or
yeah,
we should have done something with that. And then here you are doing exactly that. So, you know, you get done recording an episode and working on the magazine, and then you go outside to light up a cigar and you, you know, put together some YouTube content, just have, you know, hanging out and chilling. So,
yeah, I mean, and that's been really fun too, because, yeah, I mean, that's like me and we don't really have any tentative schedule for that. It's just kind of like Phil texts me that morning and says, you want to smoke tonight? Or I smoke, or, you know, I text him and say, you want to smoke tomorrow night? And he's like, yeah, sure. And then it's like, you know, I'll send a few messages to some friends and be like, hey, if you're free, here's the link, jump on and join us. And so we usually don't really have any idea of who's going to join us. Like, it's almost a surprise. It's a surprise for Phil most of the time, because he has no idea who I've talked to. But it's been a very, very like venomous centric show, just because Phil's, you know, he's a big venomous guy. And mm-hmm. I do share that passion, even though I don't keep anything but the pig now. But I mean, it's so cool. You know, we talk about like the things that a lot of people don't talk about, you know, like the difference between Parias and Cryptolytrops and Trimeresurus. You know, that's that whole taxonomical nightmare. You know, we were talking about that one night. It's like, what's, you know, what separates the three? And, you know, Henry Martinez is one of Phil's really good buddies. And, you know, I consider him a good buddy now. And he chimes in the chat and, you know, he jumps on occasion, but, you know, it's just fun, man. We just, whoever feels like jumping in, we pretty much, if they're like, hey, send me the link, I'll send them the link, and they're right there. It's just kind of a free-for-all. Like, I like that it's sort of like the cast is always changing in a sense.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I see you guys run for a couple hours sometimes.
Yeah, that's a long format show, that's for sure.
It covers everything. Yeah, I've popped on and caught you know, plenty of chunks of episodes over the, you know, past few months and seen what goes on and scrolled through the chat, and you guys literally cover everything.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you literally, so like you have your breeding stuff, which is a lot of colubrids and chondros and things. And then you have Herpetoculture Podcast, which is just this broad spectrum of everything that's fair game. Then you have Chondrocast, which is this narrow scope right there. And then you got Herpetoculture Magazine, which is a breach back into full broad spectrum. And then you've got Snakes and Stogies, which, although it is open-ended, has like this other angle to it. You literally just immerse yourself as much as possible on a daily basis.
So, yeah.
Snakes and Stogies is just kind of a nice way to like get out there and just talk and share what you've been gathering with people, and then have that infectious sort of conversation spread and permeate and go off into more. And so that's kind of, I think that's why people really enjoy the live stream approach of it, is because it is not edited. It is not
planned,
I guess, in any way. Hidden behind any veil. Yeah. And it's all just off the cuff. It's all very raw and real, and it's really authentic.
See, so, and that's what I love. I love not having an outline. Like, I love just like someone hitting record and saying, okay, go. You know, I like just sort of letting it flow. And that's what it is. I love, you know, I wake up every day excited to immerse myself in the hobby in pretty much any way I can, be it working on the magazine, be it talking to people, you know, like yourself and the group chats and stuff I'm in. And it's just, you know, like I said, total immersion. It's just, that's, I just want to swim in it, you know, all day, every day.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a hard time focusing at work, because like, I want to keep tabs on channels and podcasts and other people's breeding projects and new designs of products or new species coming into the hobby, or, you know, first time a species has been bred. So, you know, like, there's so much going on at any given moment that if you stay plugged in, there's all sorts of stimulation going on. And so, I mean, I literally work with reptiles 24/7, yet somehow I find myself being distracted by the hobby quite specifically, regardless of what I'm going on. So I don't blame you, man. There's a lot going on.
And that's, I mean, a big part of everything that I've been doing is just a desire to, you know, I want to make the hobby better. I want to make the community better. I want to contribute, you know, in some way. I want to be involved. I want to do what I can to make it better than the, you know, the day before.
Right. That's a good goal to have.
And there's a lot of misinformation out there too. And so I hope that the content that I put out, be it audio or visual, you know, I hope it helps in some capacity, because I also try to make sure that anything that gets put out there is as accurate as it can be.
Sure. Sure. No, yeah. I mean, that's the best endeavor right there, is just to always be as accurate as possible. So
I figure if I plaster the internet with all of it, you know, it's bound to stick for somebody.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Share it everywhere. Get other folks involved. Have a wide audience with it. Somebody's going to figure it out. They'll find it.
You might be sick of seeing my name.
Eventually it'll stick.
Yeah. Just pissing.
There's a reason why it works. Well, yeah, and you talk about how many folks have their first experience with a species based on, like, seeing an animal on the cover of a reptiles magazine or something that caught their eye. There aren't magazines out there like that anymore, so this is definitely going to, you know, sort of fill that void, I think, for many folks coming into this hobby, in this world.
Yeah. So
I think it's a good thing. So we're over an hour, and I haven't forgotten that I've sort of started doing these closing questions, because like we were talking about earlier, you emulate the folks doing it before you and create your own path. And so the good folks at NPR used to do this all the time. They still do with new guests and first time guests, but I kind of came up with like a few. They're just my own flair, and they'll change and evolve as they go through them and do them more. And if I do and don't like them, but so far, these are the five that I keep tinkering with and keep in here. So for number one, who do you look up to most in this reptile world?
No. That's tough. You know,
see, when I have people tell me that, that's when I know it's a good question.
Yeah, and you know, it's Rob Stone has been on a lot of stuff lately. He was on James's Phelan's podcast recently, and then he was on NPR with the, you know, the IJ roundtable. And man, the more I hear him talk, and the more I talk to him myself, which isn't very often, you know, I'm constantly just blown away by the amount of stuff that he knows and the amount of stuff he's done, and the fact that he kind of, you know, he does it sort of from, you know, behind the scenes in a sense. And you know, there's a reason Eric Burke talks so highly of him, and you know, Eric Burke's another one. You know, Harlan, there's a laundry list of people that are huge influences. You know, Rob Stone, like I said, he's just constantly impresses me, and Eric is obviously the, you know, the OG, and Harlan's a good friend. I talk to Harlan all the time, and he's always, like I said, he's always imparting wisdom, and you know, I love the fact that he's willing to basically share any quote-unquote secrets and, you know, his perspective as far as, like, the business side of the hobby and, you know, handling things and, you know, just... I've learned a lot from him, and he does a lot of things that not many people do as far as customer service and stuff goes. So I definitely try to take things from that and use it for myself.
Yeah. All good answers right there for sure. What is your holy grail reptile to keep?
The Ganyosoma Jansenii, the Sulawesi black-tailed rats. Those are, I don't know if I'll ever get any, but man, those things look cool. Anytime I
those
see them,
those are sweet.
Anytime
those
I see, really, yeah,
really awesome snakes.
Anytime I see them online, man, I'm like, God, those things they look just awesome. And then probably the Corallus rutenbergeri, especially like Nipper Reed over in the UK has some just really dark black ones that have a lot of black on them that are just absolutely incredible. And then as far as like venomous stuff goes, Atheris nishii have always been probably one of my favorite snakes, bar none. Just the coolest looking snake you could ever imagine. But the Atheris genus is always one I've been fascinated with since I was a kid. That's been a group that I can't get enough of, even though I'll never keep them, you know.
Yeah. Speaking of those, I was really encouraged to hear, and I apologize, I can't remember his name, but the gentleman you had on from M Toxins recently, who was talking about how there's a lot of research going into the Atheris venom and how you know, dangerously wrong it is to underestimate that venom.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it was a bummer because he's like, you know, I have a non-disclosure, so I can't really talk about it. And I was like, damn it. Because I'm so curious, because I remember him posting on Instagram a while back about how they were doing a study. And I was super excited about it. And then I never heard anything about it again. So hopefully he'll keep me in the loop on that. He's actually a really, really cool guy. So
I'm sure as that paper gets published, you'll be one of the first people to be sent a link to it, you know.
I don't know, we'll see. But they are, I mean, that whole genus is just like Boiga, super, super underestimated, and a lot of people, they get written off as, you know, oh, they're not that toxic. It's like, no, they're small. That's the problem, you know.
Those things are dangerous.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, they're like little colorful landmines.
Yep.
All right, so if you could take an entire bedroom, devote it to one species, gut it, build a whole vivarium, any way, shape, or form, with whatever materials, have a team come in and do it, like, you know, no issues with budget, slice of an environment in a bedroom, what would you create?
I'm thinking I would do like a big rough scale enclosure, like rock wall with the escarpments, and you know, get like a trio in there, like two females and a male, and do like the scrub grass, like the.
Have you seen? Yeah, have you seen what Peter Birch has been posting with the rock works and the spin effects and the hides and stuff under the bottom?
No, I haven't.
Peter Birch posted a cool, almost walk-in enclosure, like a closet size enclosure, where mm-hmm. he did sort of that same deal where he made some cool rock ledges and rock walls and like a waterfall running through and lights, and has a couple roughies living in it, and it's killer.
Oh, I have to look that up.
It's so cool to see. Yeah, yeah, he's getting back onto his YouTube channel a little bit more lately, yeah. So he's been posting some cool little things here and there.
Yeah, so rough scales
so that's get the first. As soon as you said that.
Yeah, rough scales get the first vote, and then scrub pythons, like a pair of nice like Wamina scrubs or Aru scrubs, and those are nice too. You know, something with those.
Oh yeah, that would be so cool, man.
They're cool snakes.
Those are animals that would use that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're great snakes, and they would use that environment and whatever sort of topography and enrichment you gave them. Like they would be all over the place. All right, if you could go back in time to a younger version of you right before you were getting into reptiles for, like, you know, the stage you're at now, what sort of wisdom would you go back and impart upon your younger self?
I would probably warn myself that I'm going to get hooked and it's never going to go away. It's weird, man. I mean, like,
so you can be prepared to, like, devote yourself financially.
yeah, definitely. Be like, set aside some cash because this is what's coming in a couple years, and you're gonna not have money for it, and you're gonna be really bummed about it.
Yeah, have it like an emergency stash, and just be prepared for this to be your life. All right. And then the last one, if you could pass on one piece of advice to the listeners, as far as keeping snakes or reptiles would be, what would it be?
Ignore social media. Enjoy what you're keeping. Stop. Take a minute when you're cleaning or something. You know, if you're handling one of your animals, just take a minute, enjoy it. Sometimes, you know, even I get caught up in day-to-day life and I'm cleaning stuff. I'm like, yeah, whatever, it's chondro. But then maybe one day one will shed and I'll take it outside to take some pictures and I'll look at it and be like, man, there was a point in time where I was a kid where I saw the Signal Herp ads and reptiles, and I dreamed about being able to keep this kind of stuff and never thought I ever would. You know, don't lose, like, I know everyone complains about social media, but you know, some parts of what I see on there make me think that sometimes we get caught up in the popularity contest and the social aspect of the hobby and not what we're all there for in the first place. You know, so just like stop and enjoy it, like take a minute on a regular basis. You know, remember that we're all very lucky to be able to have what we have. And, you know, if you don't have it, but you're working towards it, then, you know, make it happen.
Yeah. No, that's great advice. I think that's good advice for everyone to hear. And even if you're good at remembering to stop and smell the roses, it's good to do it regularly out of practice, just as sort of like a mental check sort of thing. I think it's important.
I mean, just have fun.
It'll keep you on an authentic path. Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, I have my Brettles, and anytime I take my Brettles out,
if it isn't fun, why are you doing it?
Right. I take my Brettles out, man, and I'm just like little, you know, the 7-year-old inside of me is just, he's there still, you know. Anytime I see a snake on the street or something when I'm walking the dog, you know, that kid in me just comes back out, and it's, you know, it's never gone away. And I think that's, I, you know, I don't want to sound like psychotic, but I mean, this hobby, man, it's just, it's literally like ingrained in me at this point. You know, it's, it is like sort of my existence in a sense. And it's not something that I don't see ever going away. You know, it's something I'll be doing until, you know, the day I'm no longer around. And I hope that if that becomes the case, then people can look back and say, you know, we really enjoyed THP. We really enjoyed the magazine. We enjoyed everything you did for the hobby and helping, you know, move it forward. So.
Yeah. Legacy. Leaving a good legacy. I think, I think that's super important. So I could not agree more with all of that.
And that time,
is there anything else that you wanted to?
Yeah, I mean, that enjoy, you know, enjoy it, enjoy what you're doing. You know, that ties into, you know, you never know. I think maybe not all people, but I think a lot of people lose sight of the fact that at one point, like, this is all going to end. You know, your life, you're not going to live forever. You get one shot at this. You don't get a say in when it does or doesn't happen. You know, like the, you know, the forest thing should be kind of a wake up call to a lot of people. Like, you just, you don't know. So you need to enjoy it and you need to, you know, love it and stick with it and just have fun with it and enjoy it and ignore the bullshit online. You know, other people's opinions of things for the most part don't matter. If your animals are healthy and happy and you're healthy and happy, that's what it's all about.
Yeah, very true, man. Couldn't have said it better myself. All right, well, I think we're going to kind of wrap this up. Did you want to throw anything out? Any final thoughts? Any, you know, US ARC things you want to throw out there? Or any alerts or initiatives or, you know, speak to the people and then let them know how they can get a hold of you?
I actually did a post on the magazine page today. About US ARC. I think a lot of people don't realize that for a simple $5 a month, you can support US ARC. I don't think that's too much to ask. That's, you know, that's like so many other people have said, that's a trip.
It makes a huge difference.
I mean, that's two monsters from the gas station. That's, you know, there's a lot of things that you could give up just for a single day and pay for that in a month. You know, it's,
it's 60 bucks a year.
Yeah.
You know, it comes out to 60 bucks a year per person. And if you multiply that by, you know, 1,000 people, it's 60,000 bucks that goes to US ARC for just everybody throwing $5 a month their way. That's huge.
And they did, you know, they did a live stream with Ryan McVay and the, the guy from the Madison Area Herp Society. I don't know if you saw that. It was just from the other day, actually. Mm-hmm. And I watched that yesterday. And, you know, he made a good point where, you know, Facebook, unless you're advertising it with them now, it's pay to play. Like, you probably won't get seen. He's like, we have, you know, this was Phil Goss. He said, you know, we have 100,000 likes on our Facebook page. But, you know, because of the way Facebook is made, like, structured now as far as pages and businesses go, very little people are actually seeing this. And so that's what I, you know, after I've been a member now, I've been doing the $5 thing for a month or two or so. And then I, you know, when he said that, yeah, we have a lot of followers, but not a lot of people see or even share the stuff we're doing. I was like, people, you know, the reason it's not getting done is probably because people don't realize that it's only $5 a month. So I hope that everyone can pitch in and help with that. Cause I mean, $5 a month is, you know, that will, when there's strength in numbers like that, you know, they do so much for us in the hobby and in every state. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter what state it's in, whether it's your state or not.
Yeah.
You know, they do way more than I think.
There's two situations going on right now in Florida and Alabama that they just sent out an email alert on. So if you're a member, you get these email alerts where they'll keep you up to date on the different legislative projects they're working on in whatever state that's ongoing. So if you want to be informed, be supportive, and contribute, literally $5 a month, It's super easy to sign up for on USARC's website. All you have to do is just go to usarc.com, right?
.org. Yeah.
.org. Okay. Yeah. usarc.org. There's a little thing on the right hand column, I believe, to sign up. It's just super easy. It takes 2 minutes and you will make a huge difference. And then if you share that information with two of your friends and they share that information with two of your friends, we've all seen how this goes. Yeah. So yeah, it can spiral in the best way possible. So if you're listening to this and you aren't a USARC member, please go and change that.
Well, I mean, Phil even said on that live stream, he's like, even if you don't, you know, financially back us, he's like, even just sharing the things we post helps immensely in them getting seen and people seeing what's going on. So something as simple as taking the 2 seconds hit the share button, you know, and that helps them immensely too. And I try to share all their stuff on all the platforms I can. And, you know, people, like I said, I don't think people realize just how much they do for us. I know up until recently, I didn't realize how much they really did for us until I kind of stopped to actually look into it. And then realizing, you know, $5 a month is nothing. And if that's all I got to do to help keep the wheels a turning, you know, then by all means, I'll do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, keeping reptiles is a luxury and a privilege. And if we want to keep that, we got to support the folks who are putting in the work to make sure we can keep that. So
I'm sure it's a full-time job. I don't envy any of the headaches he deals with, I'm sure.
Yeah. Phil goes through a lot more than he'll ever admit, and he'll do it with a smile on his face too. So he's a good man. Yeah, he's a good man. He's relentless about it. So we need more Phils. So, well, Justin, thank you for coming on tonight. I appreciate you helping get the show back from a brief hiatus amidst all the chaos in the world.
Yeah, man.
Like I said earlier, we're going to ride the storm out without Andy up front for a little bit, but he'll be riding behind the scenes, keeping me on my game and keeping the show sounding good and out there for everybody. And hopefully we'll be back to our normal schedule starting with this one.
I miss Andy.
I think we'll probably just shoot for getting it ready by next Wednesday. Dude, I miss him too.
I don't get to
hear from him too often, partly because I know he's a breath of fresh air. He's got great perspective and it's always, you know, good getting into good, healthy discussions with him. So I'm hoping, you know, things at work slow down and, you know, things at home start mellowing out. He's been mentioning trying to curb his reptile collection a little bit.
Yeah. Life gets in the way, man.
So. Yeah, it happens. But we'll get him back soon. He just needs a little bit of time to get some affairs in order, I suppose. Maybe, you know, reduce the workload at home and elsewhere, and you know, we'll have him back. So whenever he's ready, we'll be ready for him. And in the meantime, we'll just keep his seat ready. Keep his seat warm, you know?
Yeah, man.
So.
Absolutely.
All right, man. Well, how can people get a hold of you? Palmetto Coast Exotics and all that good stuff?
Yeah, Palmetto Coast Exotics, the ChondroCast, Herpetoculture Podcast, Herpetoculture Magazine, YouTube, all that good stuff. Not a hard man to find.
Yeah, if people are listening to this show, they should already know who you are and where to find you. So.
Yep.
All right, man. Well, don't hang up right away. I just want to make sure that this audio file loads properly.
Okay.
So we'll wrap this up. And and we'll catch all of y'all in a couple weeks. I have no idea what we're doing. We're just getting back on this horse, so we're going to see what happens.
I don't know where we're going, but we're going.
Appreciate everybody sticking through the we're going. The gas is on. We're just buckled in. So we're going to see if there's a wall in the way or more track. So that's just how it rolls. So, but from both Andy and myself, thank you for everybody who's listening. Justin, thank you again for coming on.
Thanks, man.
And talking shop. We appreciate y'all hanging out in the reptile room with us tonight. Thanks again. Later.
Bye.